I hold the record as being the youngest ever newsreader in the BBC's history. I have personally voiced 30,000 radio and TV commercials. The only thing that keeps me from the breadline are these two very thin pieces of mucous membrane.
Conversations, an occasional radio moment series in which we talk to those who made a difference. Peter Dixon.
I grew up in Belfast in Northern Ireland. That's where I was born in 1957. Quiet district of Belfast, very quiet area in the east of the city. It was just me, my mum and dad, and my sister, and it was a very happy childhood. My mother said that I was a very easy child to raise, but she did, in my later years, confide in me that she said that I was a very compliant child, but that I would always agree to do something. She said, "Can you go and clean your room," or whatever it might have been? I said, "Yeah, of course I'll do that right away." And about an hour later, she'd come in and find the room in exactly the same state as it was. I went to a school called the Belfast Royal Academy. Previously, before that, I was in the prep department of that school, so I had a very privileged kind of sheltered existence. Remember, this is the time in Northern Ireland when the troubles were rather high. This, we're talking about the early 70s, when Northern Ireland was in a very dark period, and every day I had to traverse this city to get to school, and it was two buses, into Belfast city centre and another one up the Antrim Road to my school. I was literally crossing a war zone to get to school most days. Human beings are adaptable, aren't they? You kind of get used to it, and people just treat situations like that eventually as normal because we knew no other life. And so you end up going to school and crossing streets that have been barricaded by buses that are on fire or were smouldering from the night before. And you went to bed at night to the sound of gunfire and explosions.
The army peace line zigzags between the troubled centre of Belfast, the Protestant Shankill Road, and the Catholic Falls Road area. It is now complete except in one place, Dover Street.
I can go back to when I was probably about 4 years old. I remember my father had this fantastic wood-encased radio, Radiogram it was called, which he'd bought as a mail-order thing. And this arrived in the house one day, and he switched it on, and it just, there was valves in it, and it glowed. And it had this wonderful grill at the front and this fantastic dial. You know, you could wind the radio dial up and down. And there were these really exotic names like Hilversum and, you know, Radio Erin and RTE, and Russian radio stations would pop up on the long wave. And I just think this is just the most incredible thing. Here we are in Belfast, in this almost remote part of the United Kingdom, miles away from the glamour of London. And here am I in my tiny little bedroom listening to a broadcast of somebody on a radio station in Europe talking to me. And I thought this was just captivating. Growing up, my mother was a great radio fan. She had the radio on all the time. And I remember before I even went to school, when I was probably must have been about 3 or 4 or 5, listening to the radio with her, particularly shows like, you know, Listen With Mother was a great favourite of mine. I used to love that because this woman would pop up at lunchtime, wherever it was. She'd say, "Hello, children." And I'd think, "Oh, she's talking to me.
Are you sitting comfortably? Then we'll begin."
There were stories and little characters, and there was always something going on that was of interest to children of that age. It was a marvellous introduction to radio in many ways. You know, you'll probably hear this from other people when they talk about their early influences. It's largely from when they have listened to the radio at a very early age and had that moment where they think, this is just magical. And then when I went to school, I was very keen on English. I joined the Dramatic Society and I took part in plays and was encouraged in that aspect by several teachers of mine who I will always be indebted to. And they encouraged me, and I, as I grew older and went through the school, I took part in many of these productions and indeed played some of the leading roles. We had an old boys meeting a few years ago, and some of the people who were at that were saying that they remembered my performances, although I've long forgotten them. But apparently I made quite an impression. But those early experiences probably counted towards what was to be my future career.
This is the BBC Light Programme.
One minute. Here. How do you do?
How do you do?
Come here often.
Well, anyone, I have some announcing to do.
Oh, what'd you say?
Oh, nothing much. Things like, this is the BBC Light Programme.
Oh, that's very good, isn't it?
And then as I was growing up, the radio was on. I frequently remember listening to programmes like Beyond Our Ken, you know, in the early 60s, and then Round the Horn from the mid-60s onwards to the early 70s.
Hello, anybody there?
Oh, hello, I'm Julian, and this is my friend Sandy.
Yes. And those programmes, you know, Kenneth Williams, Hugh Paddock, Kenneth Horn, fantastic use of radio and the imaginative use of radio, which I think fired something in me because I used to enjoy the mental pictures that radio would paint. You know, there was nothing to look at. You'd have to use your imagination, which is why I fell in love with radio, I think, because you can go anywhere and be anyone and do anything on a relatively modest budget just with some sound effects or a couple of upturned coconuts for horses. I fell in love with the medium and particularly with sound. Those are some early influences. And also, I think, listening to those wonderful, fruity, stentorian voices on the Home Service and, naturally, Radio 4 on the BBC.
Now back to the BBC cuts and their effects. One of the casualties is Radio 2's long-running serial, Wagoner's Walk. And this afternoon, listeners were able to hear the last episode of the show.
People like Brian Perkins, Peter Donaldson and John Hedges, Harriet Cass. Even before then, people like MacDonald Hobley, who I don't remember because he was a bit before my time, but, you know, I've since heard him. And all through that timeline, everyone that's come after those early pioneers in radio, they're standing on the shoulders of those giants. Those sounds and those the tonality of their performances carry through history, carry through time. And it's wonderful to hear how they maintain that tonality, but at the same time, their voices change, the delivery styles change. It's almost like the zeitgeist moves on very slowly and inexorably, and you get this change from the very formal clipped tones of MacDonald Hobley to the more relaxed tones of somebody like Eugene Fraser or Peter Donaldson. You can hear those resonances going down the years.
BBC News. This is Peter Donaldson.
I hold the record as being the youngest ever newsreader in the BBC's history because at the age of 17, when I was in my A-level year, actually, I was considering what I was going to do for a career and whether I was going to go to university or not. I was looking around as to what university to go to, and I decided that I would go to Queen's University in Belfast to do a subject which I knew nothing about, but it sounded exotic. It was psychology. But before I made the final decision to go to Queen's, I went up there to their open day the year before I was due to go and was wandering around. And I saw this stall, and this was for the University Film Society. I got chatting to a guy, and he said, yeah, come down next Saturday and see what we do. And I went down the following week and had a look at the Film Society, and they made little films, and he had actually just made a documentary about something. And he said, would you like to narrate it for me? Because he knew I was interested in radio, and I said, yeah, I'll narrate it for you. So I narrated this documentary. Turns out this guy was not at university. He was a BBC television cameraman who was helping the students to set up cameras and things. So I narrated this little documentary. It wasn't going to go anywhere, but I narrated it. He said, that was very good. He said, you might be interested to know, he said, that the BBC, BBC Radio Northern Ireland, are looking for a part-time radio announcer, and you might want to apply for that. Well, I thought, gosh, I'm 17 years old, they're not going to consider me. And there's something about the impetuous youth in me. I thought, well, why not? I'll apply. And I did. And to my utter amazement, I was given an interview. It was a man called Michael Bagley. I'll never forget it. He was a ruddy-faced man with a huge beard and a wonderful cultured Northern Ireland accent. And he was the head of presentation at BBC in Northern Ireland. And he interviewed me and he said, well, what do you do? And I said, well, I'm a student. I was still at school. I wasn't lying particularly, but I looked older than I was. And these were the days before human resources, of course. So I didn't have to produce any documentation at all, I don't think. And he just took me at my word. He said, oh, you're a student. Yeah, great. He said, well, can you read this? And I read a bit of news. And he said, can you read that continuity announcement? And I read that. And he recorded it. And he said, thanks very much. Shook my hand. And that was that. And then that was on the Wednesday. On the Friday, he rang me up and he said, we'd like you to start on Monday. And I was still at school at the time. And my mother was in the hall as I took the call. And I can remember her as I put the phone down. I told her the look of shock on her face. I said, this is unbelievable. I said, I've got to go and do this. And she said, when do they need you? I said, well, because you've got to go to school. I said, well, it's after school. It's in the evening. And she said, well, we could probably just about manage that. So there I was, you know, at 17 years of age, being driven to the BBC by my mother, dropped off round the corner so nobody would see, going in, got my pass, I think I did a week's training with them, and then straight in at the deep end, reading the news and doing the closed down, as it used to be in those days, closed down news, and before they played the national anthem and switched everything off. And so I found myself in this very adult world, but so exciting for a 17-year-old, 18-year-old boy, as I was then, you know, to be doing this sort of work. It was just incredible. And then I left school, went to university, and all the way through my 4-year degree course at Queen's University, I was a part-time newsreader and announcer at the BBC. Ended up working across both TV and radio, so I would read the news, do continuity announcing. I would also be on Saturdays reading the television news. I always thought that just reading other people's words was not quite a respectable job. Because I'd done a degree in psychology and I'd come out of a very good red brick university and I had this degree and, as I say, I'm not a natural academic, but I got a reasonably good degree. I thought that just reading other people's words was perhaps not the most respectable of careers. So after about a year or two of this, I decided that I would become a journalist, a radio reporter and journalist. And I went through a bit of training with the BBC and was enrolled as a reporter on what was called Good Morning Ulster. And I was reporting on the death and destruction that was all around us at that time. I stuck that for about 2 or 3 years. And many of my contemporaries at that time went on to have very distinguished journalistic careers. You know, Nick Witchell and Jeremy Paxman was there, Kate Adie, loads of them. But for me, I didn't have the printer's ink in my veins. I wasn't a committed journalist. It wasn't the sort of thing that I was very good at. I decided reluctantly to go back to what my heart was telling me I should do, which was performing on the radio and reading other people's words. And eventually I'd go on to do free-form presenting. But at that point, it was just reading the news and doing continuity. So I really enjoyed that. It was a 2-year diversion into journalism. It wasn't a complete waste of time. I did learn a lot about interviewing people, which came in very useful later on. I went back to the BBC Northern Ireland presentation department, and I worked with Michael Bagula. I was doing TV and radio continuity and news reading on Radio Ulster and the occasional programme presentation. And I did that for about 3 years, until about 1982, when I saw an advert in the BBC's in-house Aerial magazine for BBC Radio 2 announcers in London. This was a 6-month attachment to the presentation department in London, and BBC Northern Ireland would release me to go to London to work for 6 months and develop my skill sets. And I thought this was just the most marvellous opportunity. So I applied for the job, was given an interview, and met a man called Ian Purden, who was the Radio 2 presentation department editor at the time. And the controller of Radio 2 was a guy called Brian Marriott, who was an old school, let's say, you know, ex-Navy man who smoked a pipe and wore a blazer and drank scotch at lunchtimes, as most of them did in those days. It was the most wonderful place. And I remember walking in through the front doors of Broadcasting House in Portland Place in London, looking up and seeing Eric Prospero's aerial above the lintel of the door at Broadcasting House. I kind of caught my breath because I just thought to myself, of the people down the years since the 1920s when that building was built had walked through those doors, my idols, my people I'd listened to on radio way back in my bedroom in Belfast. And it struck me how much of an opportunity this was, and I wasn't going to mess this up. So I walked into that wonderful marble-lined reception in Broadcasting House, and it's adorned with all these fantastic statues and awards and memorabilia. And I remember going into that interview, and I thought, I've got to get this job. It was one of those moments where I was so determined to do it. And very, very fortunate to say that I was given the job, 6 months attachment. and was due to go back to Belfast, which I didn't want to do. And a month or two before I was due to go back, they called me in and said, we'd like to extend your contract for a further year. Would that be all right? I almost kissed them. Would that be all right? Yeah, this is really where I need to be.
The late night show for late night people. Peter Dixon.
But I was doing everything on BBC Radio 2, from reading the news on Terry Wogan's show to introducing fantastic performers like Eric and Ernie or the programmes that Radio 2 had. It was just wonderful. And I met some fantastic characters, learnt an awful lot about radio, learnt a lot about using my voice and how to communicate and how to read copy. It was the most wonderful learning experience I think I could even have imagined or asked for.
It's 7 o'clock. Good morning. Here's the news read by Peter Dixon. The Times and The Sun have been printed at Rupert Murdoch's new plant in East London. Times journalists have voted to move there. The Prime Minister meets senior colleagues this morning to discuss her speech in the Westland debate. And the American Super Bowl they're celebrating in Chicago after victory for the Bears.
Well, Radio 2 in those days, I think in the early 80s it was the last golden period, in my view, before Bert came in. It was populated by the senior producers and the management were chaps who'd come from service. They'd been in the army, in the navy, and in other areas of government, perhaps. So they were all clubbable, very chummy people who understood that as long as the work got done, they left you alone. So these were the days when the BBC Club was just across the road in what is now the Langham Hotel, which was a wonderful building. And the BBC Club was a huge place with several bars in it where people would go to at lunchtime and think nothing of sinking a few pints or a bottle of wine and then going back to work and maybe go for a snooze and then maybe get the work done and then maybe work a little bit later in the evening just to get it finished. Some of them didn't manage to get it finished. We won't mention any names, but it was a very liberal place to work, very nice place to work. And by and large, the people that I worked with were really lovely. And the announcing team in those days was really great. And they gave me a lot of assistance and help, and I learnt an awful lot.
This is Nightcap. I'm Peter Dixon. Coming up next, Anarchy from Alexei Sale. But first, we welcome listeners who've just joined us on BHF FM from the Tommy Vance Show on Radio 1 with this, the comic strip's own contribution to rock and roll, Bad News, and their excruciating rendition of Bohemian Rhapsody.
Because Radio 2 was a 24-hour network, part of the announcing duties was to present a programme on Radio 2 called Nightcap, which went from, I think, 1 o'clock in the morning till 4, and you were literally just given a box of records, and that was it, and told to get on with it. You know, thinking now, if somebody gave me a box of records and said, could you go and fill 3 or 4 hours of national radio airtime, I think I'd probably panic. But then, you know, as you do something like that all the time, you kind of get used to it. So broadcasting through the night was a wonderful experience for me because the management weren't there, there was nobody around, it was just you, as I say, a box of records, a bunch of carts to play and an engineer on the other side of the glass to make sure that your show was properly balanced. And I loved broadcasting at night. The audience at night is a very strange audience. They're very loyal. They write to you. They communicate with you. It's a very one-to-one experience. So I learned a lot about talking to the singular person at the other end of that microphone through those nighttime shows. A lot of people make the mistake that you're broadcasting, so you're talking to a large audience. Your delivery should be huge. And hello, everyone. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. No, this was a very singular delivery, I learned. And that has stood me in good stead when it came to my future career as a voice artist. Talking to one person is the key. I think you've got to know your audience really well and adapt your delivery in such a way that they feel like you're talking to them.
All right, this is Nightcap on BBC Radio 2, the home, don't forget, the home of light entertainment, or in this case, extremely light entertainment. Well, with us now is Alexei Sale, who's here to read episode 4 from his book, Geoffrey the Tube Train and the Fat Comedian. Alexei, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Now, perhaps you'd like to read
the great thing about then, broadcasting house in those days is there was this huge canteen on the seventh floor where all of us, everybody that worked there, would congregate at lunchtime. including the presenters. So I found myself one day in the queue, queuing up to get my lunch with my tray, and behind me was Steve Wright, who then was one of the biggest broadcasters on Radio 1. He had the afternoon show. But he'd come from Radio Luxembourg, and he'd come from a background of listening to a lot of American radio, and had brought this new zoo format to the UK, which I was a fan of and listened to a lot. So there I was in the queue, and we got talking, and I don't know, we kind of hit it off right away, and we started meeting regularly for lunch with him and his posse before they went on air. I don't know how it happened. One day I started doing a silly voice or something, and he said, oh, that would be good. We could do that on the show, because he had character voices, phone-in characters. So I developed this character voice. We called it, for want of a better word, Mr. Mad, because it was kind of slightly surreal, off-the-wall delivery. And I started doing this character called Mr. Mad while I was reading, while I was a newsreader on Radio 2. So I found myself in the Radio 2 newsroom reading the 3 o'clock news, and then half an hour later, or even 15 minutes later, in the same studio, picking the phone up and doing this Mr. Mad character down the phone to his studio on the other side of the road. I was very concerned that I didn't get the two mixed up.
Yeah.
What?
I'm living inside. I'll get this, pal. I'm living inside the Mace in the House of Commons, pal.
No, not today.
I'm living inside the Mace.
Well, talk to you later,
Mr.
Mad.
I've got raving dropped on the railing floor.
No, never mind.
I'm up in the repair shop right now, but I'll be back tomorrow.
We developed other characters for his show as the years went by. This would have been, I suppose, 1985 to 94, when he was in the afternoons. And there were other people contributing at the same time. Gavin McCoy was a fantastic. He did characters. And Richard Easter was also there at the time performing characters. And Phil Cornwell was there. This was a very fertile time for me. I was then learning that I could do character voices, and I found I had a penchant and a talent for it. And at the same time, I was also presenting my own show on Radio 2, which was called Peter Dixon's Nightcap. So I was learning and creating stuff, very creative time for me, writing scripts as well for Steve's show and my own. And I found that was probably the most fun I've ever had on radio. It was brilliant. Radio 2. One of the great things about working at the BBC in the mid-80s was that I consider there were some of the best broadcasters the BBC's ever had was still there. Because I was relatively young and inexperienced, I made it my business to learn from these people, not just by listening to them, but by actually watching how they do it. So I was in the very fortunate position as a Radio 2 announcer of having access to all the continuity suites. I had the pass. I had the golden ticket to go in there and make friends with the engineers, the studio managers, and eventually with the presenters themselves. So I met some fantastic people and watched them close up, watched them work close up, people like Steve Wright and Kenny Everett, who was on Radio 2 at the time. I used to watch him like a hawk. Adrian Just, you know, with his comedy clips. I got to know John Peel quite well. A different style of broadcasting, but equally as valid, and what a wonderful, intimate style he had. The master at talking to one person. He mumbled and sort of bumbled his way along. But that's what made him so compelling to listen to, and knew his subject so brilliantly. But I used to go into the Today studio and watch people like Sir Robin Day work.
Turning for a final moment or two, if we may, Mr. Callaghan, to the problem of the Parliamentary Labour Party now, following this overwhelming conference decision.
I don't know what problem
and
there
pick
is
up
in the
cues visually, how they worked, what kind of notes they were making. I'd sit in with Ray Moore in the mornings and watch him. Very interesting, very nervous man. I always remember he used to undo his trousers, which was a bit disconcerting at the time, until I realised he wore these quite tight trousers. He undid the belt and the top button to give his diaphragm a bit of room so he could get his breathing right. But he sat through the three-hour show he used to do in the mornings, chain-smoking Park Drive cigarettes and drinking black coffee and shaking like a leaf. You wouldn't have known it from his delivery. He was so assured, but at the same time, like the swan pedalling furiously underneath.
So may I, as the very first voice on Radio 2 in 1988, wish you a very happy new year.
So I watched all of these people and learnt how to do the craft, learned how to be a broadcaster, learned how to be a radio presenter. I made it my business to learn from people by watching and listening how they did it. So I'm very grateful for that experience that the BBC, you know, gave me. So after about 9 years at Radio 2, I came to the conclusion that I wasn't learning anymore. I didn't feel stagnant, but I felt that if I stayed any longer, I probably would feel a little stagnant and I wouldn't be learning anything and I wouldn't be moving forwards. So reluctantly, after 9 years, I decided that I would try and see if I could move out of Radio 2. And this opportunity came along where I was invited to audition for a new radio station in London called Melody Radio. It was run and owned by Lord Hanson, and it was to be based in Knightsbridge. And I was invited to present the breakfast show, 6 till 10. And I thought this would be a good move. The money was good and it would get me out of the BBC and it would mean I would be free from 10 a.m. to go and do other things, which I was now being asked to do radio commercials. So I went to Melody Radio and hadn't quite grasped the fact that Melody Radio was probably the antithesis of everything that Radio 1 and Radio 2 was in terms of its delivery.
The best way to relax in London. This is Melody FM 105.4. The radio service for London from Hanson PLC.
It was billed, and there were huge billboards around London at the time saying, Melody Radio, more music, less talk.
Like sailing on a sailing ship to nowhere.
So I found myself for 18 months, I don't know how I stuck it that long, to be honest with you, reading liner cards, which were rotated on a carousel. We had to read these cards in between playing four records in a row. It was perhaps the dullest thing I've ever done in my life. Job satisfaction was zero. It was tedious in the extreme. So after 18 months of that, I decided I had enough and then took the plunge to go completely freelance. Because by then, I'd built up a reputation for being a voiceover artist on commercials. So I was, after my show on Melody, I would get in my car and I'd drive to Bristol or Newcastle or Birmingham and spend 4 hours at each of these radio stations reading a bunch of maybe 12 or 15 radio commercials and then driving back home again for 7 o'clock in the evening and getting up at 4 in the morning. I mean, it was exhausting. But at the same time, I was, you know, I had a good career going, I thought, and it was a great jumping point for me to get away from the BBC to learn new things.
Here we go. It's Britain's brightest game show. Bruce's Price is Right.
And then I went into TV and, you know, I learned stagecraft from Bruce Forsyth. You know, he used to do all his own warm-ups on The Price is Right. And he'd walk out in front of every audience and do half an hour of spontaneous warm-up. And he was a master at engaging with a live audience. And just watching how he did that was a masterclass. And you couldn't buy that kind of lesson.
Do you know, I'm so thrilled tonight because I've been chosen to be the fifth Teletubby.
And then in comedy, I learned a lot from Harry Enfield and people like Paul Whitehouse and Kathy Burke, you know, their comedy timing. Jerry Springer, I learned from him how to manipulate an audience, how to, you know, wring as much emotion out of a line. Paul O'Grady for his comedy timing as well. I worked with him. He was great to watch. I think I'm probably a product of all of that, as we all are. We all absorb stuff. I think we all, you know, if you're going to succeed in this business, you have to use these opportunities to learn, to watch and observe and listen. Because if you don't, it's going to be a longer journey for you.
101.6, the new Star FM, Royal Berkshire.
Between Melody Radio, when I was doing The Breakfast Show, and going completely freelance, there was a small, short period where I was asked by a friend of mine whether I would be interested in being the launch breakfast show presenter on a station called Star FM in Slough. Slough, of course, you know, the subject of comedy right from Betjeman right the way up to, you know, The Office, is exactly as you would imagine. So there I was on day one of Star FM in the Observatory Shopping Centre in a radio studio which overlooked I think it was Greg's, the baker's, presenting The Breakfast Show. Quite what I was doing, I don't know. I think I just thought this would be a nice little stepping stone or a unique experience which needn't detain me for too long, but at least it would give me a little bit of a laugh, and it was relatively close to where I lived. So But I stuck that for a very short period of time. It wasn't the happiest 18 months of my life, but, you know, you sometimes do go down cul-de-sacs in your career, don't you? And you think, perhaps that wasn't the best idea.
Welcome to the birth of a brand new star, the all-new 101.6 Star FM. I'm Peter Dixon. I'm wishing on
a star. I think in those days, and we're talking now about the late 80s, early 90s, there was a small number of us who drove from radio station to radio station. I think there were probably about 14 or 15 voices. It was called The Circuit, and we just drove around. Some of them stayed in hotels. I wasn't that crazy, but I remember driving one day to Newcastle, and it was the most horrendous weather. It was in January or something. I crashed the car and went off the road and ended up at the radio station 4 hours late, and I thought, well, I can't do this any longer. So I was delighted when ISDN came along. ISDN, for those who don't know, is a digital line that gives you CD quality audio between you and your remote station where you're being recorded. So I built a studio at home, and I was able to then carry on working without the aggravation of driving hundreds of hours on motorways every month. So I had this studio at home, and I think I had and probably still have the perfect job. I don't necessarily have to go anywhere to earn a living. I can stay at home in my studio, choose when I work with the people I like, and come to London when I like to come to London or when it's required. I'm kind of spoiled and almost, in some senses, virtually unemployable now by anybody because you become quite selfish.
If you have a faulty kitchen appliance, you should call one of the British Gas team.
Well, I was totting up the other day about my career, looking back on it, and I think I try and keep a record of all the different things I've done. And even I was astonished to discover that I had worked on over 120 TV shows and series. I'd voiced channel promos for something like 60 UK and USA stations.
Experience a brand new night of E4 telly awesomeness. So rad, they named it twice. Sunday, Ruddy Sunday.
I have been a featured voice on something like 30-plus AAA games titles. And this is the most astonishing statistic. Add it up, all the commercials I've done. If you add all of those up, I have personally voiced something like 30,000 radio and TV commercials in my 40-year career.
Have you ever wondered why Domino's pizzas taste so darn delicious? It's simple. Every classic Domino's pizza...
It makes me tired just thinking about that. And I've appeared on all five of the BBC networks. And that's a heck of a lot of work. And very little of it exists. All of it is now in the ether somewhere, halfway to Mars. Some of it still exists, I imagine, somewhere. But a lot of it is so ephemeral. There's nothing to show for it, really, which is an odd thing to have. But of all the things I've done, I think radio is still the one I come back to. It's my first love. I love the theatre of the mind. I like using sound effects and creating an atmosphere with my voice and with other things like music and effects.
That was an incredible one. Thank you very much to Pete Dixon. Voiceover man.
Get in!
That was great.
Get in.
Get in.
One. But I think really TV drew me away from radio because they could see my ability to create an atmosphere or deliver a powerful performance on shows and on promos. Things like, you know, The X Factor, for instance, is a character performance because it's such a ridiculously big, pompous program. I decided that it needed a ridiculous, pompous voice. And even from series one, you could probably hear a difference. I kind of tentatively put my foot in the water with this.
Earlier tonight, 12 acts sang live for your votes. For Simon, Addictive Ladies, Journey South, The Conway Sisters and Fortune. For Louis, Shane...
As the series progressed, and it's been going for 14 years now, every year, you know, Simon Cowell says, let's make it bigger, let's make it more important. So we get to the stage, you know, of series 14 where I'm literally shouting so loudly that I'm bleeding from my eyeballs. I then was sensing that the public were getting behind this as well. They could sense the irony and the fact that I wasn't taking it too seriously. although the voice kind of has that kind of serious quality to it, there's a sort of underlying wink and a nod. This is really over-egging the pudding slightly with this kind of delivery. So, yeah, I took it to the extreme there, and I think it's now become part of the audio signature of that particular show.
Rachel Adedeji!
The problem is that on a high-profile show like X Factor and Britain's Got Talent and those other big shows that I do on television, they attract, obviously, huge audiences. And the exposure is huge. And so when those shows are airing, the only thing anybody wants you to do is that delivery. The X Factor traditionally runs from late summer to Christmas time. And so for those sort of 5 or 6 months of the year, it's all anybody ever wants me to do is that ridiculous voice. So I'm not complaining because it's been great for me. But by Christmas time, all I want to do is just read some Shakespeare or some poetry or something, or do something a little gentler, perhaps. Yeah, I think every single performer through history, whether you're a visual performer or an audio performer, will at some time or other get typecast. There's nothing you can do about that except stop doing it and do something else and try and convince people that you are capable of doing other things.
We cleared forests and built roads and highways. We even conquered the skies. British Airways, to fly, to serve.
When you're creating a character voice, you have to kind of have a very strong visual image of what that character looks like, first of all. If you're being asked to create a voice for a character, say for an animation or a computer game, then it's helpful if the producer can show you an image or of that character and a description of the character's personality traits, for instance. Is he good, bad, evil, manipulative, fun, slightly dim? So those are clues that you can use to create a character. And I largely use those cues to create various elements of how that person would sound. So if they are, for instance, slightly challenged cerebrally, then you might want to make them a little bit, you might want to dumb down the voice. Or if they're evil, you can give the voice an evil characteristic. Or you can go contra-type. You can go the way Ralph Fiennes did in Harry Potter when he created Voldemort. Voldemort's this very tall, kind of shadowy, dark figure who you would automatically assume as a character voice actor, you would give him a very dark, deep voice. But Ralph Fiennes, being the genius that he is, gave the character this rather reedy, wispy character. Ah, Harry Potter, we meet again. But that monotonous kind of reedy, wispy quality gave it that kind of malevolence that maybe a slightly more over-the-top, deeper, darker, more obvious delivery may not have done. I've only really worked with you could count on one hand the producers I've worked with who I really rate. A vast majority of producers really find it difficult to communicate what they want to hear. They won't tell you what they want to hear until they hear it. So part of the challenge of being a voice artist or a broadcaster is to know and understand, A, what the copy and what the piece requires, but also what's inside the producer's head. And that is a skill that you can't really very easily teach quickly. It's only something that you can learn over time. So part of my job as a voice artist is to understand what's inside the producer's head. I can ask them questions. You can ask them questions, of course. Try and elicit from them what they want. Some are better than others at describing it. Some of them say, well, you know that film where that character, could you get something along that tonality or that TV show? Do you remember that guy that said that? And then one of the great resources nowadays, of course, is YouTube. So they can say, listen, I'm just going to dial this up and you can see, have a listen to this character. Those kind of clues are great and they give you an idea of what is in their head. And then there's the process of trial and error. So you listen very carefully to what they want. You read the copy, what you're being asked to create. You then make your own mind up. You probably have maybe 3 or 4 options. And then you begin exploring those options with them on the mic. So you start saying, well, let's try this and see if this works.
It was you, Charlie. It was you, Charlie.
Yes, OK. Like that again, but could you try and make it even more New York? I really want to smell those docks.
Yes. I could have been a contemporary.
And they'll say, yeah, it's kind of 80% of the way there. Can you make it different or do this? And then you try and pitch it up and down. There are sort of several elements of a character. There's pitch, which is the pitch of your voice, whether it's high-pitched or low-pitched. There's age. You can create an age in your voice artificially. You can make him older or younger. You can give the character an accent, a dialect or an accent. And then lastly, you can create what is called a defect in the voice, whether that be a lisp or a stammer or some kind of oddity about a characterful quality to the voice. So pitch, age, accent, and defect are the four main components of character voice. So by dialing those elements up or down, each of those individually, you can create an unlimited almost range of characters quite quickly. So using the using that, what I call the rule of pad, and the information from the script, and trying to get inside the head of the producer or director, usually after a period of time, hopefully, you know, within 15, 20 minutes, you can find that character. The trick then is to lock that down and keep it, because when you're doing gaming or long-form projects, such as audiobooks, for instance, you need to kind of make sure that what you've developed is consistent right across the brand. Because in gaming, it's non-linear. You know, you'll take the computer game will take a piece of your text, your speech from something you recorded on a Tuesday afternoon and match it next to something you recorded on a Monday morning. And so it has to be consistent.
And this is the legendary U87 microphone used by the greats such as Frank Sinatra and the Beatles and, of course, me.
I keep notes. I also frequently ask the engineer when I'm recording to just remind me what we started with. So I'll go back. It's called character creep. So you can get, over time, you can the thing mutates and changes slowly without you realizing. So it's always a good idea to go back and listen to what you did at the very beginning so that you keep that consistency all the way through the project. Vocal health is, of course, of great concern to me because it's the only thing that keeps me between where I am now and abject poverty. So when you think about it, it's quite scary. The only thing that keeps me from the breadline are these two very thin pieces of mucous membrane in my throat. They have kept me and my family safe for years, and I've had a good life. So looking after your voice as a voice artist is crucial. And how do you do that? I'm not saying I adhere to all the rules that you should, but I know how to do it. I don't say I do it all the time. The only thing that gives you that you should do as a voice artist, any things you should do, are hydrate properly. So drink plenty of water. In fact, I'm going to have a drink now. Look, I'm practicing as I preach, or preaching as I practice. H2O. So systemic hydration, very important, because you can get vocal nodules, dry, crackly voice if you don't hydrate all the time. Secondly, I think that you should have a decent night's kip, because if you come into work to do a job and you're tired, you can hear it in someone's voice, definitely. So get some sleep. And thirdly, I think just looking after your voice. So when you're out in a club or a bar at night, try not to shout too loudly. Next morning, your vocal folds will be inflamed. You'll sound great on cigar ads or a commercial for Jack Daniel's whiskey, for instance, but you'll sound terrible for everything else. So look after your voice and don't overuse it too much. I remember in 2012, I was asked to do the... I drew the short straw in the London Olympic Games. They asked me to come in and would I be interested to be the announcer in Horse Guards Parade at the beach volleyball event. No sooner had they asked me than I'd signed the contract and the ink was dry. That was the easy bit. Going back to tell my wife was slightly more difficult. However, that's another story. But this was a huge open-air venue in Horse Guards Parade. 20,000 people gathered to watch this Olympic event. And there was little old me with a rather ineffective microphone, as I remember. It was attached to a headset and I had to address this huge crowd. And it required talking quite loudly in this open-air environment, and after the first day, I nearly lost my voice. It was very hoarse. So I had to go on vocal rest, and overnight, I wasn't speaking to anybody. I was drinking lots of water. I got lots of sleep, came in the next day, struggled through that day, and so it went on for about 10 days. And there were two of us actually alternating as announcers in this open-air venue. Both of us suffered from vocal fatigue and inflamed larynx, vocal folds. And it was very challenging, but at the same time, what an opportunity. And what a great event, what a great memory I have of working in the at the London Olympic Games. It was unique, never to be repeated, and one of my highlights of my career, I think.
Guy? Guy, is that you? How'd the audition go?
I didn't get it again. When are these talentless bastards going to realise that I'm bloody good?
Oh, Guy, you know I love you, but you're going to have to do a bit more minicabbing.
Oh, yeah, Penny? That's just great.
In the late 90s, I think it was, early 2000s, I was working with a producer called Harry Thompson, who's sadly no longer with us, but he was a bit of a genius in the light entertainment field. He had produced Harry Enfield and Chums, and he'd worked on a lot of shows. And he was working on this show called Monkey Dust, which was a British animation series for BBC Two. And he asked me if I would be interested in playing a couple of parts in this animated series. And I got the script, and I was looking forward to reading it. And I opened up page one, and I honestly couldn't stop turning the pages. I was crying with laughter. This was by far one of the funniest scripts I'd ever read. So I bit his hand off. I said, yes, I'd love to do this. And I got involved in Monkey Dust. And Monkey Dust ran, I think, for two series. And then we lost Harry. Harry lost his battle to cancer and sadly died. And there were no more were made. But it's since become something of a cult show amongst the cognoscenti, the people that enjoy good animation, adult animation. And this show painted a very bleak picture of Britain in the early 2000s. And it has a following across the world. I mean, it's sold all over the place, particularly in America. And it's a very dark series and a dark humour, which I like. But I was very proud and particularly pleased to have been involved in that. There's so many things I've done over the years, from Cirque du Célébrité on Sky TV to Family Fortunes. I was in Harry Enfield and Chums. I worked with Jerry Springer for a while on ITV. Paul O'Grady, Anton Deck. I worked with Chris Moyles for quite a while on radio and on his TV show. And one of the funniest things I think I ever did was read the football results on BBC Final Score television. I was invited up to Manchester to do this, read the football results for comic relief in that ridiculous voice that I do. And I was just wheeled into the studio, sat at this desk, and there was a television monitor in front of me, which was black. It wasn't switched on. And the floor manager said, you'll be on in a minute. And I said, well, where's the script? He said, no, you're reading the football scores. I said, no, but I don't have them. He said, well, it's on the monitor in front of you. And I said, well, it's not switched on. And he said, oh, blimey. He just reached over and he switched the monitor on. And literally, as the monitor came on, I was introduced. And now it's time for Final Score. Here's Peter Dixon. And the monitor burst into life, thank God. And there was no script. I was reading the football. I hadn't realised this. I was reading the football scores off the screen at the same time as the viewer was seeing it. And I wasn't familiar with the layout, how the score, you know, it was Manchester United 1, Chelsea, whatever the score was. And in the first one, I got so confused and befuddled. I read Manchester United 3 and then looked across. And my eye went right across to the right-hand side and I read the pool's forecast number. So I actually said, Manchester United 3, Chelsea 26. I could hear this kerfuffle in the studio. And the floor manager was on his hands and knees with his finger pointing at the right set of numbers. Oh, it was so horrendously embarrassing. And there was laughing in the background. I think it was Gary Lineker or somebody was just wetting himself. So embarrassed. But it was for comic relief, so in a way it was kind of appropriate. As for gigs that I haven't done, I mean, I've done so many and so much. I've never read an audiobook, and I'm not particularly keen to do one. People keep saying, why don't you do an audiobook? It's probably the most challenging thing you could be asked to do as a voice artist. Long-form work is not particularly well paid, actually, but those that do it say it's very rewarding, but I don't think it would be for me. I'm quite lazy. I like to get in and get in and out quickly. As for work, I haven't done. There's one thing that I haven't done. I'd love to be the voice of the London Underground. Mind the gap. I've hinted at this for many years. I've pleaded with London Underground. It's fallen on deaf ears so far. My only hope is that before I shuffle off, that my voice will be recorded and somehow be on at Oxford Circus Station. Mind the Gap would be a great sort of fitting end to a career, I think, wouldn't it? You know, we're all standing on the shoulders of giants. You know, all these people through the ages we listened to, grew up with, worked with. So my voice probably has elements of all of these people. There is a little bit of the DNA of Ray Moore, of Terry Wogan, of Peter Donaldson, of John Hedges, of Eugene Fraser, of Astley Jones, Brian Perkins. All of these people that I worked with, listened to, grew up with, worked with. There's a little bit of me in them, perhaps, as well, I would hope. And maybe those that came after me. But there's definitely a lot of them in me. From the very early days of radio, I listened to, I think he was probably, and definitely, actually, my radio hero was Terry Wogan.
I could be a millionaire if I had the money.
And I'd listened to him for many, many years, principally because he was, A, a great broadcaster, but B, he also came from Ireland. His father was from Belfast, where I came from, so we had a little bit of an affinity, both being Irish. So I used to love Wogan as a listener, and then when I worked with him, I loved him as a colleague, and I worked with him quite a lot. And then we lost touch. I went freelance, and we lost touch. And I'd kept in touch with Alan Dedicote, who was by then working as a Radio 2 announcer and was one of Terry's newsreaders. And I said to Alan one day, I said, look, I haven't seen Terry for so many years, and I do owe him a debt of gratitude because he was very supportive as a mentor to me in the early days at Radio 2. He helped me with various contacts and assisted me in my career greatly. And I think it's only right that you should recognize that when people do that for you, particularly when you get to where you want to be. And you look back. So I said to Alan, can we get Terry out to lunch, do you think, on a Sunday after his Sunday show has finished? We could maybe go to a local restaurant and have lunch together, the three of us. He said, leave it with me, I'll see what I can do. Anyway, he came back, Terry would love that, and the day came, and this was in November 2015. So I turned up at the restaurant, Alan and Terry were already there, and Terry was delighted to see me, and we had the most fantastic two-hour lunch, quite boozy, reminiscing about the old days and about Radio 2 and all the characters we knew. And he was so generous, and I got the opportunity then, and I found it very difficult to get the words out. And even thinking of it now, I kind of find it chokes me up a little bit. Because I said to him, I said, Terry, you know, you have single-handedly been so kind to me over the years. And if it wasn't for you, I probably wouldn't be doing what I'm doing. And he said, there was a tear came into his eye, and he said, you know, that's the nicest thing anybody's ever said. I don't think I'd said it to him before. And as you can tell, I'm quite emotional now talking about it, because that was the last time I saw him, and 2 months later, he was dead.
You tell me how important I've been in your lives. You've been every bit as important in mine.
And since that day, I was so grateful for that opportunity to say that. It was almost kind of a lovely, it was a lovely moment for me to have that moment and ability to say that to him. Because I don't think he'd realised. So Terry was a great influence on me, and I owe him a great debt of gratitude for his inspiration and his kind words and his mentorship. And I don't think I would have had the career I've had it not been for him and the other people who have helped me in my career. And so, as I look forward in my career and at the same time look back, I think that I now want to give back to people in our industry. So I do mentor people, I do encourage people. In fact, I've started a business called Gravy for the Brain, which trains voice artists in all aspects of this business. And in a way, that's a very easy way for me to give back and help people get to where they want to be. And I'm always available, my door's always open, I'll always talk to people and help people, whatever stage of their career they're at, or if they need any advice. Not that my advice is worth very much, but at least I'm happy to give it freely, because I had the benefit of that kind of advice when I was starting out in my career. So I've had a fantastic career, 40 years now, and I wouldn't change any of it for the world. It's been an absolutely fantastic choice, and I'm so grateful for all the opportunities and experiences that I've had. It's interesting. It's a fascinating career I've had, and I've loved every single second of it.